Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, do you know what happens to your child's data online? We'll hear from an Irish company looking to fight this issue and from the Data Protection Commission on what's being done here in Ireland. Plus, the corporate VP for Samsung in the UK and Ireland will join me to talk about their new lineup of devices, including the lovely Note 20, which I've been using for the last few weeks. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. The issue of children's data online came up this week because the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK has set out a very clear code of conduct for companies dealing with children's data. We're going to hear from Dylan Collins of Super Awesome shortly, but this is an issue that I've been thinking about and reporting on for quite some time now. The internet is a tool, and it is very much designed to make our lives easier and make certain tasks easier. But did children's use of the internet ever pop into the brains of the founders at any stage? I would highly doubt it. Today we see kids from a few months old sitting in front of devices watching Peppa Pig or The Wheels on the Bus. As with all behaviour online, this creates a digital footprint. Dylan Collins of Super Awesome joins me now to talk about this very issue. Dylan, before we talk about solutions, let's talk about the core issues. So what is or what are the problems as you see it?
Well, fundamentally, the internet was designed by adults to be used by adults, which means that most of the services and apps and games that we use today are all being fueled by personal data. So when you log into Amazon or you log into anything and you see, for example, an ad for a product that you might have seen elsewhere, that's because behind the scenes, essentially the internet is designed to track users from place to place. So it means that the more time a user spends online, the more of their personal data, their preferences, what content they look at, where they live, etc., all of that information is floating around the internet. Today, you know, children represent about 40% of all new internet users. So it's quite a dangerous idea for that level of personal data to be gathered on children and to be floating around the internet in the same way.
I know from myself, you know, if I'm with my 5-year-old niece, for example, I might allow her to pop onto YouTube Kids on my phone or, you know, just to mess around on my phone. We might look at the Smiths website and pick out a treat. If it's signed in as, you know, my Google account, how can that information be built up? Is it not just that Jess Kelly sometimes likes LOL dolls?
I think part of the challenge is that almost all of the main, the big internet companies and the main technology platforms really haven't designed, you know, for children. So what happens is that, you know, children could be using their parents' account or their aunt's account or their uncle's account or whatever, and they could end up seeing content or seeing ads that are relevant for the adult user but would absolutely not be relevant for them. So the issue in that particular case would be less about their personal data and getting captured and more about the risk that they might see something which is absolutely fine for you but which definitely wouldn't be appropriate for them. Mm-hmm. And it's YouTube actually have been one of the few companies that have rolled out a kids specific product, which is YouTube Kids, which is very specifically designed for children. But that's very much the exception rather than the general rule for tech companies.
I know, particularly over lockdown, a lot of parents were buying tablets for their kids so that they could get work done while we were in lockdown. Parents were working from home. They needed something to keep the kids occupied. If a child has a tablet of their own, you know, roughly how much data could be generated and, you know, could these tech companies have on that kid by the time, you know, they're 13 or 14 years old?
So we've actually done some research on this and, you know, we've seen that by the time a child is 13, which is, you know, usually when they're legally allowed to use a lot of these services, you know, for example, just the advertising technology companies alone might have gathered you know, somewhere north of 70 million different pieces of information on that child just because of their day-to-day browsing. Obviously, you know, with the school shutdown and lockdown associated with COVID, you know, children's screen time has doubled. In some cases, it's tripled. So that's dramatically increasing the amount of personal information that is being harvested, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, by all of these companies. So it really is a major issue.
We sometimes talk about kids being online and the biggest threat being, you know, cyberbullying or predators and so on. But there is a concern about that level of information being stored, being captured by a child before they're at the age of digital consent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the big challenges is that, you know, all of this data, you know, when it's captured, for example, by an an adult advertising technology company, or anything else, it's being shared behind the scenes with hundreds of other companies. And, you know, almost no one has visibility about where all of that information is being shared. And when you consider the granularity of that information, you know, that's capturing, you know, things like location, it's capturing, you know, things like the type of content that's being watched. And over time, it begins to create this kind of profile, you know, which theoretically could be pieced together. So whilst, you know, cyberbullying is definitely a huge issue, I think this the problem of data collection on children is over time a much, much, much larger challenge for the internet in general. And, you know, we're just now seeing and the release of this code in the UK is sort of the beginning of this realization that the internet in general needs to be redesigned to reflect the fact that kids are such a huge part of it.
I read yesterday afternoon, because I had nothing better to be doing, I read through the Data Protection Commission's consultation report, I suppose, on this issue here in Ireland. And I saw a submission from yourselves. I saw submissions from the likes of Microsoft, from Snap, the company behind Snapchat. And they are hopeful that they will have something concrete in the next few months. It's one of their big priorities of this year. So what's the status in terms of here in Ireland, and where can we improve?
Well, I think, you know, in Europe, obviously GDPR got passed a couple of years ago, which is an acronym that I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with. And that included some specific protections for children. And what we're seeing on a country by country basis is more specific rules that are being rolled out. I think in general, probably the biggest change, the biggest evolution that we need to see, and you're seeing that now in the UK, is these rules giving children protection that go beyond just their digital privacy, so that are going beyond just the data that is, you know, invisibly being captured on them and making sure they're kept anonymous, but also making sure that there are guidelines for, you know, the kinds of visual experiences that they get to see. So, you know, for example, making sure that developers which use what's called nudge techniques, which are essentially, you know, design methods that sort of encourage you to press a particular button in a game or in an app, you know, those kinds of things aren't appropriate or aren't really safe for a 6-year-old or 7-year-old or 8-year-old. So it's just sort of, you know, I would say broadly, these rules taking, you know, a much more holistic view of the internet for kids and understanding that it's not just what's going on behind the scenes, it's also what's going on literally on screen as well.
I mentioned there about the Data Protection Commission sort of document on this. And one thing that stood out to me is that, you know, some of the companies were suggesting that parents take a greater responsibility in terms of setting things up and setting their kids up online. But one line that jumped out was that, you know, some parents who are grown adults are not great at understanding, firstly, their own digital consent. They don't really know what cookies are. They don't know how the advertising tracking works. And so to place that responsibility on them without any form of education or providing them with a greater understanding kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, I think, look, there's a huge challenge here for absolutely everyone involved, from the parents to teachers to technology companies. And I think everyone has a responsibility. You know, I do think fundamentally technology companies, and actually Microsoft are a great example of this. You know, they've been investing in tools for families and tools for parents. But in general, if you look across Silicon Valley, you know, the percentage of R&D that's being spent on kid tech or for, you know, the equivalent of family tools is absolutely tiny. It barely registers even as a whole number. That being said, you know, I think, you know, parents have to try and make the effort to understand what their children are using. And that's a very difficult ask as well, you know, because everyone is tight on time and, you know, kids cycle through so many different apps and services. But that's why I think, you know, the emergence of more of these laws that are essentially defining much more responsibilities for all these big companies that are providing services that are being used at scale, you know, that are being used by millions of people, you know, it seems fair and reasonable that they would have, you know, a different set of responsibilities to try and augment, you know, what parents are trying to do in the home as well. But there's no doubt that this has all certainly been accelerated by COVID lockdown, you know. And although that being said, I think it's probably in some cases given parents, you know, the opportunity because they've had sort of more of a physical proximity to their kids to try and understand a little bit more of not just sort of what apps and services they're using, but how exactly they're using them as well.
Okay, so overall, sometimes when we hear these things, and I know when GDPR was being talked about, a lot of people were freaked out going, oh God, is this going to be a headache? But broadly speaking, if and when Ireland brings something like what the UK is introducing, this is good news for parents, for kids, and pretty much for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I said, the internet was only ever designed by adults, you know, and now, you know, when you look at the percentage of new users, you know, coming online, you know, as I said, almost half of them are children under the age of 16, you know, so it makes absolute sense that we would see sort of a redesign of how the internet, you know, has to be implemented to provide protections for them. So I think all of these rules and codes are absolutely good news for parents, good news for teachers, good news for kids. And I think, quite frankly, even for all of the technology companies, it's providing, you know, much better definition around what their responsibilities are. Because I think, you know, for many years in many countries, in many jurisdictions, the laws were lagging behind the reality of how the internet was being used. And now all of these things are starting to catch up. So I think it's absolutely a positive for everybody.
Dylan Collins of Super Awesome, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, very thought-provoking stuff there. I would love to hear what you think about this issue. Do your kids have access to the internet? Do they have their own device? Are you aware of the data collection that goes on? Email techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. Because I do think there is a bigger issue at play here. It's not just about the tech companies making the information look brighter or, you know, be displayed better for children. We need to bring parents along with us. So, you know, would you feel confident consenting on behalf of your child for their online activity? You know, it's a big decision. It's a big move to make. And it's one that you can only really make, I suppose, if you have a full understanding of the issues yourself. So do get in touch, techtalk@newstalk.com, and share your view. Coming up next, we'll hear from the Office of the Data Protection Commission about this topic.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Before the break, we heard from Dylan Collins of Super Awesome, who outlined some of the issues that pertain to children and their online presence. I mentioned in that interview that the Office of the Data Protection Commission is working on a code of conduct for this country. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Graham Doyle, Deputy Commissioner at the Data Protection Commission. Graham, you're very welcome back to the show. What exactly is being done here?
Well, I suppose if I go back to the starting point, is going back to the introduction of the GDPR itself, Jess, back in May 2018, because the GDPR introduced for the first time this idea that children need to be protected. So it's singled out children in terms of a set of society that needs to be protected and deserves protection under GDPR and data protection terms. So we have we commenced consultation on children's rights. In particular, we were focused around the social media sphere. So our consultation has contained two streams. Stream one was an adult stakeholder stream, and as you referenced there yourself, there's some stuff on the website where we got inputs and submissions from, I think it was 30 submissions were received in total. Stakeholders came from sectors including the technology and social media companies, some of the children's rights charities, public sector bodies, from the academia and some trade associations. And it was really encouraging to see the contents of the submissions and the fact that so many different stakeholders obviously see the concerns and the importance of this area and are all willing to come to the table and do their bit. In addition to the adult stakeholder stream, though, we also did and it was extremely novel, but we did a consultation with children themselves. So we consulted with them through lesson plans that we developed for all schools around the country and the youth reach centres. And it had a couple of benefits. There was, number one, there was to get their feedback, but it was also to drive awareness within that age category with the children themselves of data protection. And some of the feedback that we got from the children themselves was really, really insightful. And, you know, certainly I myself didn't realise how in tune so many children are with data protection, you know, and issues came up for them, such as they don't want to be tracked on social media, but at the same time, they don't want to pay for social media, using social media either. So we've been working on the findings, which, again, people can see on our website, www.dataprotection.ie, and we've been working on the findings, and we're currently developing a best practice guidance document, which will be completed this month. And really, I suppose the important thing to say, Jess, is there's no silver bullet in all this. There's some really big issues that have been around for many, many years. So if you take the issue of consent, for example, and this is one of the most challenging areas, not only for us as parents and for the children, but for the tech companies themselves. So here in Ireland, the digital age of consent is 16. So that means if a child under the age of 16 wants to access or set up a social media account, they need to get the consent of a parent or guardian. And there's issues around, well, how does a tech company verify that the consent provided by an individual acting on behalf of their child, that it's actually parental consent, that it's not just the child themselves doing it or somebody else giving the consent. And this, as I said, there's no silver bullet to this. We need to work through these with the tech companies. And as an example, in the US, they've got a law called the COPPA law that's been in for many years now with children. And what they have is they have a micro payment that's charged to a credit card. So, for example, I, as a parent, I give my credit card details. There's 1 cent comes off my credit card. And that's used to verify that I am the parent and I am giving my consent. There was attempts a number of years ago in the EU for one of the big tech platforms to roll this out in one of the member states. But there was significant uproar from many parents who were saying, well, this is over-processing of my personal data. So as I say, there's no simple, easy, quick fix solution to this. Our guidance document that we're going to be producing this month will go somewhere to say where we believe it needs to be. We need to be going. But then what we also want to do is we want to drive the industry together. And we're going to be working with industry to try and come up with codes of conduct around how we better protect children online.
The codes of conduct, though, that's not going to be a law. So will the tech companies and the other sort of interested bodies, will they have to comply with it?
Well, yeah, there is. The codes of conduct are set up again under the GDPR. Okay. They're a new introduction. And what will happen will be that the companies will sign up to a code of conduct. But in addition to signing up to a code of conduct, they will also be paying for an oversight body to be monitoring that they're actually complying with the code of conduct that they've all signed up to. So absolutely, there is a strong kind of governance piece behind it all that will ensure that these platforms are doing what they have agreed to do.
Okay, final question. You mentioned there that this is sort of a priority for you guys for this year. What is the timeline in terms of completing the process that you're in now and then us seeing real change about how our kids interact with the big tech companies online?
Well, as I said, the guidance itself, the best practice guidance document that we're producing at the moment, that will be finished by the end of this month, so by the end of September. And then we'll be working with industry. Like I would say, in terms of how we see improvements with how our children engage with the big tech platforms, I think the likes of even this here today with you, Jess, is really, really, it's a really important element of all of that, because there's not going to be any one point in time where we say, okay, it's all sorted now. This is something that is constant and it's ongoing. And, you know, I think the work that was done in the schools, that we did in the schools, certainly has raised the profile of it, not only within the schools, but even my own experience with my own son. He came home from school having done a lesson plan and the teacher had given him a bit of homework. So he's coming home to educate the parents. So I think it's an ongoing thing. There's never going to be a point in time where we say, oh, we're done now. It is something that will constantly happen and constantly evolve. But as I say, our guidance document that people will see will be produced by the end of this month, and then we'll be working towards driving the companies themselves to draw up these codes of conduct. And again, if you look at some of the submissions that were made to us by some of the big tech platforms, they themselves have already highlighted the fact that, you know, they would very much welcome a code of conduct being introduced in this area.
Brilliant stuff. Graham Doyle, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to the final part of Tech Talk with Jess Kelly here on News Talk. If you do have any questions or comments, or if you're after a specific product recommendation, email techtalk@newstalk.com. And the more specific you can be with your requirements, the better we will be able to help in terms of a suggestion for you. So that email address again is techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, one of the things I love the most about my job is that I get to play with new devices. A huge big box of review devices landed into the News Talk office around 2 weeks ago, and in that box was the brand new Samsung Note 20, the Tab S7, the Galaxy Watch, and the all new Galaxy Buds Live. To say I was like a kid on Christmas morning would be an understatement. They've all since gone back to Samsung, and I will have my full review of all the devices on Tuesday's Pat Kenny show. But I'm delighted to be joined now by Connor Pierce, the Corporate Vice President for Samsung in the UK and Ireland. So Connor, it's been a while since we've spoken, and in that time, not only have you brought out a number of new devices, a number of new accessories, but we've also gone through and going through a global pandemic. So from a business point of view, you might just talk through what has happened for Samsung in the last 12 months.
Yeah, obviously there's no business that has been unaffected by COVID. It's been an incredible catalyst for change in everything we do, the way we live, the way we play, the way we work. And I think it's incumbent on technology, and obviously Samsung being the leader in technology, to ensure that we use these platforms to maintain human connections and empower people to move forward and help each other, because it's been an incredibly stressful time for people, for friends, for groups, for companies. And I think the power of technology has been instrumental in helping us lean into this challenge together. Mm-hmm. And Samsung has certainly gone through a huge transformation, as well as most companies affected by this. Not just the way in which we engage with the market, but also the way in which we manage our business. Traditionally, Asian companies traditionally would encourage people to be in the office. And obviously, these days, it's impossible to have people in the office. I just read recently that I think is it 2/3 of the workforce in Ireland are working from home. So a massive shift in our lifestyle. And I think technology, again, has taken a huge leap in helping people stay connected to each other, but also ensure that we continue with our responsibility driving the business and adding value to the community and people.
Mm-hmm. When sort of COVID started to kick off, and the first time that I knew it was a big deal, I suppose, in my own little world, was when Mobile World Congress was cancelled. That, as you only know too well, is a big date in the tech calendar. A lot of the key players tend to be there. It's also in and around the time that a lot of mobile phone launches happen. So from a tech point of view and a business point of view, Samsung not having that event, and then also having to bring some of your big flagship device launches into the online realm. Like, take me behind the scenes a little bit in terms of the thinking and the conversations that were happening to ensure that you still had the same impact and you still had the same buzz as you would if you had launched at one of your big fancy pants events.
Yeah. Again, I think Samsung, in my 6 years working in Samsung, I've never worked in a company that is as agile to change. And I think that Samsung leaned into this. And I understand, you know, of course, unpacked events traditionally would be held in a physical space. And we obviously had our unpacked for our flagship earlier this year. And since then, we've had several virtual unpacks, most recently, obviously, the Note series, which we'll talk about on the Power of Four. But, you know, it's been incredibly encouraging to see the team lean into this challenge and work together like never before and find ways in which we can bring our flagships and our experiences and our ecosystem to life virtually. A big learning for us, because obviously it's not something we have done in the past. But it's, I think, looking at the results and looking at the business success and looking at the way it's helped, I don't like using the word modernize, but I think certainly make our business more effective and building these digital platforms. I think it's there's a silver lining in terms of how we've managed the process internally.
Yeah, and I'm excited to talk to you about all of the stuff that you've launched in the last little while, because we've had the Note range, we've had the S range, and then also the silent but deadly player is the A range, in my opinion. The A71 is one of the little gems of the year that perhaps could easily get overlooked because it's not a flagship phone, but the fact that it's not a flagship phone means that it's probably more available and accessible to a lot of people who don't want to spend big money on a device. Talk to me about how your portfolio works from the mobile point of view, because there are the three distinct ranges.
That's correct. And we are incredibly proud and encouraged by the success of the A series. I think traditionally you can look back and maybe we've been over-indexing in the past on our premium range, driven by the S series and also the Note range. And I think one of the areas where we should have improved earlier is our A series, more of the sub 600 euro segment. And the A series, as you say, the A51, A71 have proved incredibly successful. What's important is it's successful in several ways. One, you get premium features in an affordable device. And obviously we've really listened to the consumers and they're looking for an outstanding battery, the best screen, and packed with features that are relevant. So I think we've really hit a magic note there with the A series, and it continues to go from strength to strength. And obviously, it's not just about 4G. Naturally, we're continuing to lead in the 5G space, and the A95G has been really strong as well. So I do believe that we have a very strong portfolio and a much more balanced portfolio in the past. Obviously, the S series has been the driving force behind our business, particularly in the premium. The Irish market and the UK market is quite unique in Europe in that it's driven primarily by the premium segment. Mm-hmm. And I know in Ireland that the Irish team there have done an incredible job driving leadership in that space. So I think we're in a good place to drive to continue that momentum. But what's important, apart from the mobile portfolio you've just mentioned, is one of the things that I'm very passionate about is presenting the ecosystem of Samsung to consumers. And when I say that, I talk about smartwatches, I talk about tablets, and I talk about smartphones, and also our Audible wearable range. So I think when people use more than one device, it's a much more delightful experience. And we also know that it improves their retention, our loyalty to Samsung. And if I look at just the mobile space, we've done a good job. I think last year, 1 in 4 customers had plus one device. Sorry, I beg your pardon. 1 in 5 customers last year had plus one device. And this year, we see that growing to to 1 in 4. So we know we have a lot of unpolished gems and great flagships in their own categories. I think the opportunity for us is to ensure that people understand the benefit of buying into the ecosystem, again, not just in mobile. Because you think about consumer electronics, we have TVs, washing machines, other domestic appliances, which will all ultimately be connected.
Yeah, and I want to talk about 5G, and I also want to talk about the Note in just a minute. But you mentioned there the competition, and I know it's not polite to mention the competition by name, so I won't. But we know that some of your very high-profile competitors are going through a bit of a wobble for a number of different reasons at the moment. Has Samsung decided to, you know, shout about the range of their portfolio from the A range to the S range to the Note range to make sure that consumers know that it's not just the S20, you're not just the S range. There is something for the consumers who want something either a bit cheaper or something that's high powered for multitasking, business focused output.
Yeah, a very important point. And again, I think we're privileged to have such the breadth of our portfolio. And again, not just the portfolio, but also the ecosystem. And it's something certainly we're leveraging within the market. And there is, of course, a lot of volatility in our competitors' base in particular. And that's a good opportunity for us to lean into and welcome some of our consumers back to the Samsung home. Whether that's an A series or whether that's a Note or an S series device, I think looking at the portfolio, we offer great choice. And a very important part of that choice is when people are holding their devices for a much longer period than they would have been a few years ago, up to 30 months these days. I think it's a considered purchase because you're going to have that device for longer. And I think these days, considering, although we're at a very early stage of 5G, I think people really need to consider this is a long-term purchase and embrace this 5G opportunity because 5G is coming. I mean, 30% of the population in Ireland the population coverage in Ireland is 30%, and it's only going to grow as the networks roll out, as the networks mature, as obviously there's more competition in the market, the awareness ultimately grows, and the services, whether they're gaming or productivity or media consumption, etc. The world is about to change significantly when 5G gets going, and we want to take a very sizable chunk of that, which we have currently, albeit the volumes are relatively small as we go through this journey. So I think that it's not just the breadth of portfolio, but you will see, and you have seen, 5G infiltrate across all the majority of our price points, which is very important for us.
In relation to the 5G side of things, a number of people have asked me, you know, if I'm due an upgrade in the next 2 months or so, should I pay the bit extra to get a phone that is 5G enabled? Because I'm someone who only changes my phone every 24 months or thereabouts. Will you be future-proofed and will we have coverage worthy of paying the extra bit of cash to get the 5G phone in the short term? Or are you better off just sticking as you are for another 2 years and at that stage when we have a higher population coverage, then plunge and go down the 5G route?
Yeah, I would say straight away, seriously consider purchasing a 5G device now. And let me explain why. Of course, we're at the tip of the iceberg, but Ireland is quite far advanced compared to many European markets. So with a 30% population coverage of 5G as it stands today, and yet a lot of work to do in terms of rolling out that and maturing the networks, Ireland is still at the forefront. If you think about when 4G launched many years ago, Ireland actually launched 4G 3 years after many, many markets, the majority of markets in Europe. So we're actually ahead of the curve. And with that comes an opportunity because I think we're working closely with the operators in Ireland. Obviously, we have a very wide and we'll continue to broaden the portfolio to our 5G. But I do think that it's a worthwhile investment for a few reasons. One, 5G will come to where you live. The services will only improve. And I think particularly in this environment, if you think about 2/3 of the Irish workforce are working from home, having that 5G compatibility will certainly help productivity, whether it's productivity or whether it's entertainment. A recent research shows that those who are considering 5G do it for a few reasons. 81% of them look for faster download speeds. About 80% of them look for improved streaming. And about a third of them are looking for gaming. And just give you an example on gaming. So in the first month of lockdown earlier this year in March, there was a record number of mobile games downloaded globally, 1.2 billion, if you can fathom that number. Mm. So there is a huge appetite for gaming. And also, as I mentioned, many people are working from home. So 5G is a great platform upon which we can have a more balanced lifestyle and more productivity and more entertainment. So it's certainly worth considering purchasing a 5G device.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, I'm using the Note at the minute. And what I have been struck by is that I'm very lucky in that I am still coming into the office every day, and I have been the entire time, because journalists are deemed essential employees before anyone gives out to me. And so we've been coming in doing our jobs. But using the note, it struck me just how powerful this is. And if I wanted, I could connect this to my screen and I could use it as a device. It's going to help me get more done. It helps me get more done when I'm on the move. I'm someone who kind of answers emails or edits video or whatever it is when I'm on the Lewis. I'm constantly on the go. And this phone is so powerful. It's actually a great time for Samsung to bring out a phone, but it's also a great opportunity for users who are having to change how they work, who maybe are salespeople who are no longer, you know, on the road, who are office workers who are now working from the kitchen table. To have this in your back pocket and to have the power associated with it, it could be a game changer for some people who've maybe never considered the note range before.
Yeah, I totally agree. And looking at the early signs since we had our pre-order and our launch, the Note 20 has performed exceptionally well in Ireland. And for many reasons you mentioned, of course, we have a very loyal Note base in UK and Ireland, and they tend to use the device. Yes, for gaming, about 43% of those who are purchasing the device use for gaming. They use for video streaming. But I think, as you mentioned, it's an incredibly useful tool for enhancing productivity. The main reason why people purchase a Note device is also for the use of the S Pen, which has had significant advances. So I'm really encouraged by the early signs. I think the team have done a great job. And to your point, I think it works like a computer. And, you know, I'm in an enviable position whereby, do I bring my Note 20 as a mini computer? Do I bring my Tab S7 5G device? I end up grabbing what's most convenient, which is my Note 20, and using that for my work and for my play. So it's been very encouraging. I think the UK and Ireland business markets have been leading the way globally when it comes to the Note take up since launch. So we're very happy with that.
One thing that we can't really avoid talking about is the cost of the phones, because they are, like, particularly the high end phones, obviously they're high end, so that there is going to be a cost associated with them. But very often when I tweet out, you know, as I watched the Unpacked event online and I tweeted out the cost, some people do sort of balk, because anything, like I would always say, anything over 200 quid for a phone, you do have to think long and hard about it, because 200 euro is 200 euro and anything beyond that is crazy. We're now seeing phones regularly that are going over the 1,000 euro mark. What is the, not necessarily justification, because I know the tech is great, but how can basically people convince themselves that it's okay to spend that kind of money on a phone?
Well, I think more than ever, I think technology and smartphones and tablets play an even more important part in people's lives since COVID launched, since COVID landed. So I think the question is about the premium, is about affordability. So, as you say, it is packed with features. It is a mini computer. The technology that goes into these devices is phenomenal. In fact, you don't really need necessarily to carry multiple devices around. The Note 20 or something similar from Samsung Premium would be sufficient. But let me put some facts behind that. So the above 1,000 euro mark price segment represents around a third of the market in terms of value. And Samsung is enjoying leadership in that space. We have over 50% market share in that space. And we don't take it for granted that people are willing or able to purchase or afford such a device. So what we are doing, we're addressing this concern by making sure that we knock down some of those barriers. So if you think about it, obviously the market is saturated. Everyone has one, maybe multiple devices in their pocket, in their bag or at home. And what we're doing is making sure that we enhance the value of the trade-in, so they can offer that old device as a trade-in. They can use early upgrade programs. They can go interest-free, et cetera, et cetera. So there are many ways in which we can make it affordable. But what's interesting is that despite the fact that there's a stressed market, people really value their mobile device, especially if it's packed with features that are relevant to them. So I do believe that, and the numbers speak for themselves, that Samsung enjoys a very strong space there, because one, we offer the best alternative, the best options, and secondly, we also make sure that we can address some of the affordability issues.
Just finally then, we are still in the middle of this pandemic. Well, we hope we're in the middle of it and still not at the beginning of it, but will this impact the Samsung calendar in terms of, you know, I kind of live my life by when the phone launches are happening and so on. Do you anticipate next year there being a change to the output and the product launches as a result of COVID-19?
I can't predict what will happen in the future, but we've certainly learned a lot. And obviously, most recently, when we had the virtual unpack for the Note 20 and the other devices, I think we've learned a lot. And we had really good responses and engagement from the media and the market. So, you know, we have an incredible, I suppose Samsung is an incredible position in that we have continued opportunity to launch new devices. You know, in our DNA, we have this relentless innovation, but not just for the sake of innovation, but meaningful innovation, and bring it all together across consumer electronics and mobile. So what I'd love to see in the future is that we continue to bring these experiences together. So we offer one Samsung experience, and maybe in the future we can talk more about smart things and the smart home and the Internet of Things, because ultimately that will be the glue or the platform that connects all these devices together. And that, I do believe, is the future, which is why also 5G is very important. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's going to be an incredible, exciting time. And of course, it's lots of uncertainty in the market, etc. But one thing that we do know, that within the DNA of Samsung, that we just continue focusing on listening to consumers and giving them the best experiences across multiple categories and making their life easier so they can connect with their friends, improve their productivity, and have a more balanced life or lifestyle. And hopefully, whether this new normal, I don't even like using the word new normal, but I think there's many learnings from the experience we've all been through in the last few months. And I think that it's our job to continue delivering good experiences and helping people and communities through this period.
Yeah, and look, as you said, we could go down the route of smart things and the smart home and the future of things, but there was just so much to talk to in the mobile and accessory portfolio alone.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted that I got so much of your time. So thank you for that. Stay safe, and hopefully I will see you in person very soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much for your time.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcasts on the Go Loud app in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Farty's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.
Looking some toes, and the spots like the dark, uncanny like a living.